From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Today, a program about rural health and medical education. We talk with the chief executive of East Adams Hospital in Ritzville about his facility's struggle to stay solvent. Todd Nida says the hospital is working to overcome some past fiscal mismanagement, but also factors that challenge most rural hospitals in the Northwest. Last week, medical students around the country learned about their first professional assignments as new physicians. We'll hear from two Spokane medical students about their future plans. And we hear developments from two Spokane medical residency programs. One is a long-standing program that's expanding. The second one is brand new. The doctor will see you now on today's Inland Journal. We checked in this week with Todd Nida, the chief executive of East Adams Rural Healthcare in Ritzville. A month ago, he held a news conference to share that his hospital is starting to emerge from a serious fiscal crisis. Today, Nida says East Adams is still on that path.
Financially, things are starting to look much better. We're starting to turn a corner a little bit. Feel pretty hopeful about our numbers.
Nida says some of the crisis was caused by financial fraud. Two past administrators had withheld information from the hospital's board about the depth of those fiscal problems. He says the hospital's lawyers and administrators are working with its creditors to restructure some of the debt. There were also some timely infusions of cash, and voters approved two tax measures that will help with operating costs and to fund an ambulance service.
The big news is we're going to keep our clinic open. With at least one provider.
One other development, the federal government has agreed to allow East Adams to change its stature from a critical access hospital to a rural emergency hospital. It will no longer serve as an inpatient facility. It will focus on emergency care, its clinic, and a few other outpatient services such as radiology. Residents will have to go elsewhere for procedures that require more than a 24-hour hospital stay. I asked Nida to make a list of bullet points. What are the most significant things that make operating a rural hospital challenging?
Reimbursement reductions year over year.
That's the amount of money insurance companies, the state and federal governments pay the hospital to care for patients. Often, they don't cover the full costs.
The other big issues for us, I would say, is small population bases that are aging. That makes it difficult. Higher Medicaid, Medicare percentages. Payers continue to be difficult to negotiate with. We're working through the Rural Collaborative Group, which is 31 hospitals right now that we're a member of, to work on those payer contracts in the future to try to improve our rates with payers. Because, you know, as a small one-off rural hospital, it's pretty hard to negotiate good rates. But you combine all 31 of us and we'll have much better ability to get a better rate negotiated in the future. So the other tough thing is, you know, it's this continued compliance, what is required to be compliant with quality reporting. It requires a lot of admin for the quality and metric reporting that we have to do. So a lot of rural hospitals are admin heavy, and that makes it very difficult when your revenues aren't there. So that's an ongoing challenge that I think rural hospitals nationwide are going to have to start addressing. You know, how do we manage this top-heavy administration in small community hospitals? You know, that we may have to start looking at neighboring hospitals and say, what can we do together admin-wise to share admin to try to reduce some of those costs? The Affordable Care Act kind of drove a lot of that top-heavy admin basis, and it's just something now that we have to be able to work through and accommodate. That's an ongoing challenge.
Can you help me understand the Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement rate? So you're caring for patients who cannot pay for themselves, so the Medicaid and Medicare programs pay for them. But it's not like you're getting paid the full rate for the amount of money that you throw out there. Can you explain to me what that's all about?
Yeah, so in critical access hospitals, you get reimbursed for your costs. So it's basically whatever it costs us to provide care for that patient, that's what we get paid. So there's not profit in it for us. So it makes it very, very difficult. It's a very fine line that we walk between running in the red, running in the black, because our reimbursement rates are based off of our costs. That's the ongoing challenge. It's ancillary services that we can provide that can help bolster that, But in a small rural community like Ritzville's 1,700 people, I believe, it makes it very difficult because when you don't have large volumes, you don't have the ability to beef up ancillary services, other forms of clinic services, pain clinic, dermatology, cardiology. Those are avenues where you can make better money in reimbursement through your payers and bolster your bottom line. But on the Medicare, Medicaid, it's a cost basis, so makes it very difficult.
It also doesn't sound like there's much incentive to be efficient either. If you're getting paid for your costs, what's the use of lowering your costs? Is that a, I mean, is that a, an accurate?
No, that's very accurate. Yeah, and that's the challenge, right? Because we are all trying to be very cost conscientious in everything that we do. We're always trying to drive down our supply cost, our contracted cost, our provider costs, everything that we can. But there's not a huge benefit in it other than volumes. When you can reduce enough staff that can wear enough hats to cover enough positions, that's the only way you stay viable. And it puts a lot of stress and strain on your staff, admin included. A lot of us wear a multitude of hats to try to keep, the wheels on the bus, so to speak.
So what about staffing levels? We hear a lot about not having enough nurses, not having enough doctors, and that sort of thing. Have you had to go outside to get traveling nurses to come in or traveling doctors to come in because those are more expensive than if you had them on staff?
Yeah, so during COVID, that was an issue. We did have a lot of contracted nurses, traveling nurses. Since then, we have not. We are seeing that shift within rural hospitals. We're able to now employ all of our nurses. We still have a couple contracted nurses, but as their contracts expire, we are actually hiring them back as employed. We currently only have three contracted clinical staff in the facility currently. However, we did go with contracted providers in our ER for the REH model, and that was a cost savings for us actually going with contracted providers. So that is also a shift that we're starting to see. Employed ER providers are a higher level of provider and can be very expensive to employ, but you can actually bring in contracted providers at a better rate. Because obviously they cover the benefits, the insurance, all of the ancillary costs that are involved. So for us, that works. It was a cost savings for us.
In February, you talked about having to go through two rounds of layoffs that I think you were at 69 employees, hoping to get to 55. What has happened since then?
We were given our REH designation on March 6th, so we are officially a rural emergency hospital. With that, our clinical nursing staffing plan changed. The state of Washington has a staffing committee rule where our nurses actually help dictate what our staffing models look like. Well, with an REH model, we no longer have inpatient and acute care in that wing of our hospital. Therefore, we did not need that extra nurse and NAC to cover that. So we reduced to one nurse, one NAC, and one ancillary support for every shift. So it was a reduction. So through that reduction, we did have some more layoffs where I'm not sure our exact count as of today. I believe we're around 58 currently. So we're about where we need to be. We may have some more changes yet, but may not. Financially, it looks like we might be able to manage right where we are. With the upcoming conversion of our electronic health record system, we have to be cautious about getting too lean. We don't have enough hands to do all the work. Our payroll has nearly been cut in half since I took this seat in August. So that's a huge benefit for us. And I think we're about where we need to be.
You alluded to the fact that you're now a rural emergency hospital. As I recall, you're the first in the state. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Are you kind of, do you kind of view yourself as a model or other people's, other rural hospitals calling you and saying, hey, how are you doing this?
Yeah, so part of the rural collaborative group that I'm a member of, I did just last week at the CEO board retreat give a talk about our path and how we got here. While I would not wish on anyone what we've been through over the last year, well, 8 months, basically, I do believe there are going to be others within the state that probably take a very hard look at this model. Two, three, four, I don't know, and I don't know who they are, but I know that there are some out there that are very much so struggling, and this is a workable model.
That's Todd Nida, the chief executive of East Adams Rural Healthcare in Ritzville. He says while the hospital is in improved financial shape, it's not where he can say it's out of danger. One group keeping an eye on East Adams is Prosperity Eastern Washington. It has bought billboards in places like Ritzville to call attention to the perils of rural hospitals.
These rural hospitals are owned and operated by public hospital districts. They're owned by the communities. And the communities need to know what's going on because they can't very well help out by providing additional funds unless they know.
We'll talk with Mike Bell and Pam Kohlmeyer from Prosperity Eastern Washington on next week's Inland Journal. Spokane medical student Garrett Yarter thinks it might be cool to be a small-town family doctor. He comes by it naturally.
I grew up in Chehalis, Washington, and my dad was a small-town primary care physician that kind of served the Chehalis and Centralia area. And so I had Dr. Dad growing up, essentially, and I got to see his impact on our community, and that's really what kind of kickstarted and inspired me to go into, especially family medicine specifically. I mean, there are times growing up where, you know, I have little T-ball and Little League baseball jerseys that have my last name on the back, and I walk into our local grocery store, and I have some random person come up to me and say, "Oh, Yarder, on the back of your jersey, your dad's my doctor. I need to come in to see him for something," and like, "So cool to see you," and like, that was the kind of the community feel that I had growing up.
And so do you have that yearning yourself to be a small-town doctor?
I do. I love small-town USA. I still, to this day, am intimidated by big cities and public transportation and those kind of things, and I've tried to avoid those if I can in medical school, but I loved the kind of the way I grew up in a small town, and have been trying to talk my wife into moving to small towns.
Yarder will graduate from the University of Washington Medical School in just a few weeks. He learned last Friday that his first assignment as a family medicine doctor will be at Providence St. Peter Hospital in Olympia.
It was a huge relief. My wife's entire family lives in the Olympia area, and so not only will I know that I'll get great training there from that program, but I'll have a lot of family support, and especially with a now three-week-old newborn at home, it's going to be a huge benefit to have some extra help too.
And does your father have kind of that fantasy that you'll come and be the next Yarder, Dr. Yarder in Chehalis?
It's possible. I'm not exactly sure where my career is going to take me, and it certainly has to, you know, do with job openings and the right fit. But, you know, my dad actually had to close his practice back in about 2018, 2019, just because of the financial situation that it is to run a small private practice nowadays. So he's actually relocated to Spokane, ironically, over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years. So he's still practicing here in Spokane now, but I still kind of have that small town draw, so we'll kind of see what jobs look like when I get to that stage.
So was that one reason you ended up in Spokane for medical school?
Absolutely. I think the other reason is because UW is such a good program to be at, especially if you're interested in family medicine, and I'm just not a big city Seattle person. So Spokane seemed like a slam dunk for me, just because it's a little bit more of a tolerable city for my taste.
Yarder is part of the UW's rural medicine track. He spent some of his time caring for patients at the hospital in Grand Coulee.
One thing that kind of struck me initially, and I really think it comes out of kind of leaving the tail of COVID and things like that, was I think small towns especially got their trust taken away from the medical community. And I watched my preceptors and attendings in Grand Coulee take extra time, and whether it was give extra explanations or just give patients more space to think and reason through things, to try to take back some of that trust that was once with our beloved doctors and that of historic America, essentially. I feel like, you know, going back 5, 10, 15 years ago, the way I saw my dad have trust from our community, I saw some of the doctors out in Grand Coulee trying to work on getting that back after kind of the wake of COVID happened. And So that was a really interesting kind of learning point for me, and, you know, trying to meet your patients where they're at in terms of their trust and comfortability and having those kind of difficult conversations. Like, obviously, every physician's goal is to be a well-informed, you know, practicing evidence-based medicine and things. And I think sometimes patients don't always see that side of things, but that's kind of the way we're trained to think, and with the best evidence that we have. And so taking the time to try to help patients in on that side of things, I think, is super beneficial. And that was a huge challenge.
Garrett Yarder is a Spokane-based UW medical student. His classmate, Nathaniel Lohman, took an indirect path to medical school. He was a teacher after college, then enrolled in the Peace Corps, studied in the public health program at the University of Washington, then worked in the African nation of Mozambique.
I thought I'd go for 6 months, come back, go to medical school, and that turned into about 7 years. COVID, had a kid, and then kind of woke up, you know, looking down the barrel at 40 years old, and still with this feeling like medicine was something I had to do and the path I needed to take, and it was now or never. So, you know, thankfully, it worked out to come back to Washington and study here. Came to Spokane, kind of sight unseen.
And now Lohman is staying in Spokane. He's specializing in psychiatry. He matched to the Providence Psychiatry Residency Program at Sacred Heart.
So how does being an older medical student help you, you think, be a better doctor?
I think that kind of complicated conversations are kind of real consequences and health issues that patients are going through, or that kind of colleagues are going through, or that working within a large bureaucracy that can accomplish big things that smaller institutions can't, but that also kind of have come with their own frustrations. I feel like having lived some of that helps to kind of keep, you know, all things in perspective a bit. And then particularly going to psychiatry, hopefully have a more honest and even conversation with folks in times of kind of emotional or physical distress, right? And so psychiatry kind of surprised me as being the path that I was going to take, but I think it was leaning into those conversations and then watching the folks who I thought did it well, and the amount of kind of honesty and openness that they had, and kind of feeling like, you know, really that was a skill that I wanted to continue to develop. So I don't know that I would have gotten to this point had I not had, you know, more life prior to this, honed my interest in kind of just the importance of those real conversations.
Nathaniel Lohman will start his 4-year residency program at Sacred Heart this summer. That residency program has been well established in Spokane for years, and now it's expanding from 4 residents a year to 6. Dr. Rebecca Mallow is the chief medical officer for Providence in Spokane.
Fortunately, the federal government has an expansion program to expand residency spots. Psychiatry has their own spots, not associated with the rest of our residency programs, which makes it a little bit complicated. We were capped at 3 resident funding, essentially, 3 resident spots, which means that the rest of the program was on the dollars of Providence, essentially, to support it, which made it difficult to expand the program over the last many years. So when this program came up from the federal government to expand, especially underserved programs in underserved areas, we decided to apply. And fortunately, we have some great people who have lots of knowledge about applying to the ACGME and the CMS to get that funding, and they were awarded 5 FTE, so 5 full-time equivalent spots, which over the course of a 4-year program means we could expand. What we ended up doing, we expanded 2 in the first year. We used to be a 4 first years, 5 second years, and then 5 from there out, so we went to a 6 per year throughout the whole program.
I'm assuming there's a great need for psychiatry residents and psychiatrists in general. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, the need, unfortunately, has continued to grow, partly acknowledging lots of changes in the world, but also the more greater recognition of mental health challenges. And so the need for psychiatry has just grown and grown and grown, and we've seen that continuously. It also hadn't historically been a very well-known sort of entity, I think, in some ways. And so those residency programs were relatively small including ours. And so we are recognizing that we need more. And we need more not just in psychiatrists, but also in all the other mental health care providers that we have. So we are expanding those as well.
And is there demand for your program? I mean, are there enough people who want to be as a part of the program?
Yes, we have been very fortunate. This program has filled successfully every year. They get very good candidates. We've had many from UW and WSU locally here. We have lots of local people. Our current class that we just matched on Friday has, everybody has ties to Washington. So four are out of the University of Washington program, I think two are out of WSU, and we're very excited about the local impact, and we have a very high retention rate of these people who graduate from this program. There's about 60% of them that stay local or within the region, which is huge.
Does Sacred Heart have a lot of need for them? I mean, if they want to come out of the program, is it fairly easy for them to get on at Providence?
Depends on what they want to do, but yes, generally speaking, we have quite the need. We have several open positions right now. We are trying to expand our footprint of in-person psychiatry consultation available at Holy Family, which has not historically had a psychiatrist on site, so we've expanded that footprint. Our inpatient psychiatry unit obviously has been there for quite a while, so we're continuing to staff that. We also are trying to expand our ECT therapy program, which is electroconvulsive therapy. We only do it here at Sacred Heart. There isn't another one in the region, and so trying to allow access for those. And then most importantly, in my mind, is also getting upstream. We're trying really hard to expand the footprint in the clinic. And on our outpatient clinics, we've expanded what we call integrated behavioral health with mental health counselors in our primary care clinics, in our pediatric clinics, as well as our psychology, which is similar but separate from our psychiatry department. So all of those just expanding fully access. And so anyone coming out of psychiatry right now, we will find them a spot.
So are you throwing more resources into this than you have in past years?
We are strategically placing more resources into mental health care, not always into psychiatry, although this is obviously a fairly large investment into psychiatry training programs, but we're also expanding, as mentioned, the integrated behavioral health. It's embedded in primary care so that when people are having challenges at the moment, we can connect them with a mental health counselor right there in the clinic. They can hand off to them in the moment. And that can avert a lot of crises that otherwise would brew and potentially become worsening situations. So we're trying to really get upstream of these things. And so people get the care at the right location and the right time frame that they need it. And then preserving access to psychiatry as a, you know, for those who really need the full-fledged psychiatry care.
Dr. Rebecca Mallow is the Chief Medical Officer for Providence in Spokane. The other healthcare system in town is opening a residence program in a different specialty, internal medicine. This week, MultiCare announced it's opening a new clinic where those doctors will practice. Dr. Jennifer Knowles is the chief academic officer for MultiCare.
5 years ago, we started talking about putting a residency program for internal medicine at Deaconess Hospital. There were a lot of barriers, not the least of which was finding the funding to do that. We partnered with many people both in our organization and outside the organization to overcome those barriers. And we had some serendipity along the way, including finding this clinical space. We had some very generous fundraising from our government relations team, from Senator Marcus Riccielli in bringing in a $500,000 Washington State grant. And our own healthcare system matched those grant dollars, and we were able to take that small amount of money and totally renovate this clinic space into the beautiful residency clinic that it now is. We will start seeing patients here on April 6th, and next year, in June of 2027, we will welcome the first class of medical residents to start their training in internal medicine here at this residency.
So for the average person on the street, what is the significance of opening a program like this?
Residencies are really time-consuming and expensive to start. The accreditation process is onerous. The funding is not always straightforward. So to be able to have the opportunity to bring a high-caliber residency program to the Inland Northwest is an opportunity that's too good to pass up. So even though there were a lot of challenges, we knew that we had the opportunity here and that we needed to make good on it, because the Inland Northwest is so shy of primary care physicians, and this will bring improved access in the now as we start building a patient panel, and even better access in the future when we've got a full complement of residents here, and as we start to graduate those residents in several years, and they hopefully stay here within our community to practice, the access to primary care will start to become easier for all of our Inland Northwest residents.
How do you find the people in the for your residency program that you think are going to stay?
Part of that has to do with the program director, Dr. Holland, and his team recruiting specifically for people who have ties to this area, who know and love Spokane and the surrounding Inland Northwest region, and who are committed to coming back here to practice when they're done with their training. And if we start with that end in mind, we have found in other programs within the multi-care system that that's a really successful model for being able to retain those physicians in those communities. When a resident spends 3 or 4 years in a community training, they've usually set down some roots there. Their family is established, their kids might be in school in that community. And so it's not that far a stretch to be able to say, hey, come join this organization that provided you your residency training and continue to live and practice here. So we anticipate being successful in that endeavor in retaining a large percentage of those residents for our community.
So your first class is going to be 6.
Correct.
How do you anticipate the program growing over the years?
The footprint for this program, both from a clinical space standpoint and what we feel we can support within Deaconess Hospital, we want to have a program that is 24 residents strong. That would be 8.
24 each year or 24 over 3 years?
No, 24 total. And that means 8 residents in each of the 3 classes. So for this startup year, we're starting with 6. So we will recruit this fall for 6 to start in June of 27. But each year after that, we anticipate being able to recruit for 8. And so we will achieve that size, I guess, in 2030, after the graduation of the 6 residents in the first class. Then all of our classes after that will be 8 residents strong.
So I know you're focused on this program, but I'm thinking of the psychiatry residency program is going from 4 to 6. I know WSU's got new residency programs over the last few years. Is Washington starting to solve its issue with it comes to shortage of doctors and physicians?
Well, yes, this is definitely a step in the right direction, but it's insufficient to say we've solved the problem. If you look at the demographics of existing physicians in the state of Washington, a lot of them are my age, so they're baby boomers and they're getting ready to retire. We aren't currently training enough physicians in graduate medical education, so the education that comes in a residency after medical school here in the state. We need several more residencies here in the state in a variety of specialties in order to backfill the anticipated retirement of physicians from my generation. So is it a step in the right direction? Absolutely. Is it sufficient? Not yet, but we're getting there.
Dr. Jennifer Knowles is the Chief Academic Officer for MultiCare and overseer of the provider's new internal medicine residency in Spokane. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced at SPR News. You can hear it on the radio Thursdays at 12:30, Saturdays at 2:30, or online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. And while you're there, tune in to our daily news podcast, SPR News Today, hosted by Owen Henderson. Thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.